You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. The sightings and stories surrounding a creature or creatures that live in Lake Champlain go back centuries. The Abenaki and Iroquois tribes had stories about a large creature, and since then, over 300 sightings have been reported in the modern era. This has cemented Champ into the annals of cryptozoology. Returning to discuss her latest period of research is Katie Elizabeth, who captured something remarkable last September and joins me to talk all about that discovery. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show with your contributions. Mysteries and Monsters across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes, and our exclusive merchandise site is available through TeePublic, and the link is in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Stull of the Ghost Story Guys. Let's head to Florida now to catch up with Katie Elizabeth and her continuing search for Champ. The legend of Champ has seen it become probably the second most well-known aquatic beastie after Nessie in the world. And with reports still being recorded, investigator and researcher Katie Elizabeth returns to update us on what turned out to be a stellar year for her and her research, and Champ in general. Katie, welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you so much for having me on the show again, Paul. It's been a long time.
I know it is. It's one of those things that with this lark, Katie, time seems to have no concept for a podcaster, I think. Sometimes we have conversations. I spoke to Richard Eastep recently, who's a fellow Brit living a bit further north than yourself. And it's one of those things that when I checked, it was 4 years and a month since we'd last spoken, despite the fact, I think, being connected with a lot of people on social media, you kind of think you speak to people a lot more than you do.
Yeah, definitely, for sure.
Especially in this field, and in the fields we work in, it's we're all sort of interconnected, so we're always seeing each other and commenting on our posts and our social media presences. And I think when you come to do a chat with someone, you're like, hang on a minute, I'm sure I spoke to them 6 months ago. So welcome as always.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be back and to chat about this past crazy year that turned out to be a great year, a great season for Champ.
So, I mean, obviously now you've relocated normally to have a bit of winter sunshine. Obviously, Florida is a little bit cooler than normal for the residents, and making sure that big coat sales are going through the roof in that particular state. I suppose, looking back on the last 12 months then, Katie, when you normally go up, it's kind of late spring, early summer, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, usually around June is like my first trip up, and then probably my last trip is usually beginning of September. But things got a little bit messed up this past season because the weather was very uncooperative at the lake. Lots and lots of rain, lots and lots of wind, and of course, which comes with a boat from 1985, the Kelpie 2, mechanical issues. So I managed to sort them out, but it just seemed like, you know, when you keep boat over the winter time, sometimes things just get corroded, wires get corroded and things like that. So we ran into some snags as far as that was concerned. I bought a new starter for the boat. And I started it once and went out on the lake for probably about 2 hours. And I came back and to take a break for a little bit, and I wouldn't restart. And then I smelled burning rubber kind of smell. And I was like, oh, And I'm like, it can't be the starter because I just got it. Well, it was a defective part.
Oh, no.
So I was like, you gotta be kidding. I call it the champ curse. It's the weirdest thing because I'm not the only person who's run into issues, whether it be he's dying, camera's not working, failed trips to the lake where people break down. I'm telling you, there's some kind of, it sounds silly, but I call it the champ curse. And but I managed to get through the curse, you know. I just, that consistency and being persistent, I think I seem to cut through it. I don't give up. As you know, I'm not the type to give up on anything, so it's been in my favor for sure. So all of that stuff that happened being a nightmare ended up being a blessing in the end, because I probably wouldn't have gotten what I got on September 20th of this past year.
I'm interested as well, Katie. I don't know how much you know about the situation we've got here with Loch Ness, because obviously there's a webcam and people watch it. And there's one particular individual who is notorious, shall we say. Essentially, if a seal farts in Loch Ness and the bubbles rise to the surface, he's in all the tabloids saying, all right, I've seen Nessie.
I know who it is.
And I'm just wondering, do you have anybody that deluded that's involved watching for Champ all year round? Because the amount of waves, as soon as I see that name, a cold shiver runs down my spine and I think, ah, what have we pretended to see this week?
It's so funny that you mentioned this person, because I every time I see his name pop up, I cringe. I'm like, oh God, not him again. And I just start laughing, because it's like, I mean, how many, he's obviously, he wants attention, you know, and I kind of feel bad for the bloke, you know. It's like, what's your issue? I mean, every little thing. I mean, if there was some legitimate stuff that he was coming up with, hey, all power to him. That's great. But it's just, he's grasping at straws and just being deluded and ridiculous. So God bless him. I don't know what his problem is. I mean, maybe he's crazy. Kind of seems that way, but I'm not going to be mean and say things. I've never met the gentleman before, but it's a little strange. So there are, oh boy. Okay. Yeah, there's been a couple people like that. One, I'm not going to name who they were, but I'm not talking bad, a little on the crazy side. There was one individual that was doing a little bit of research and had a hydrophone, and he kept hearing like knocking on the hydrophone. He's like, oh, it's echolocation. And I'm like, oh, he goes, what's your opinion? And he asked me my opinion, and I said, look, I said, I'll be honest with you, I think it's just the microphone hitting the side of the boat. Because it sounded like you take a teacup and knock it on the table, clunk, 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 clunk. That's what it sounded like. And I'm like, ooh. And it wasn't conducive with echolocation. It sounded nothing like any sort of echolocation whatsoever. I said, well, that's my opinion. And he's like, well, I may as well give up then. And I'm like, well, geez, if I did that, if I gave up from misidentifying something, I wouldn't have gotten as far as I have. And so there was that situation. He was telling people he had seen Champ like 10 times or something, and he saw a UFO out in the lake when he was doing research. And I said, well, did you get video of this UFO? And he's like, no, I didn't get video of it. I was just kind of watching it. I'm like, oh, for crying out loud. So he was a little out there. Then there was another person that decided to come out with some sort of a movie on Champ. There's another kettle of fish that I could really get into, but I'll make it simple. Where he had said that, oh, you have to watch this clip from a piece of drone footage that we got. It's Champ. It's Champ's shadow and next to this little buoy of a boat. Well, I went to the location. I know exactly where it is. It's a rock. And he's advertising it as footage of Champ. To see more, watch our movie. I mean, hey, great marketing skills, right?
Yeah.
But a total liar, total hoaxer and liar, which in one way, it takes away the credibility of the research that I do. But in another way, he looks like a joke and it makes my stuff look better. So it's okay. You know? So, but you do, once in a while, you do run into that stuff. You know, it's not common though. It's not common. I've noticed over the past 13 years that I've been doing the field research that you have characters show up from like God knows where, out from underneath the rock or whatever, and they show up and they start doing all this stuff and then they disappear just as quickly as they came. And I don't know. I mean, but these two individuals just kind of, I don't know. I don't know. Just, I guess they wanted attention or what it was, but yeah, it's kind of disheartening at times, but I've learned to have a sense of humor with it. And you know, you have to laugh at this stuff, you know, because it's just ridiculous.
Well, you have to, otherwise it'll send you crackers, I think, Katie.
Oh yeah.
And it is one of those things, because obviously I see a lot of it. And the thing that surprises me about lake monsters and creatures in North America, it seems that there doesn't seem to be a lot of hoaxing in that particular field going on these days. And I'm not really sure why it seems to be. Well, it seems to me to be quite immune to it, because the amount of nonsense I see in Bigfoot groups. I did myself a favor recently, and I just kind of one of those things. I thought, I wonder how many groups I'm really in on social media. And I frightened myself. I think it was 576
Oh, wow.
that have been added to the years. So I've cut back on about 500. I think because I've become allergic to red circles of in trees, Katie, and telling me that that's Bigfoot's face. And so I've just thought, I can't deal with this nonsense anymore. And you see it so much in other cryptid reports, such as Bigfoot and Dogman. Like you're talking about this particular footage. I've seen it. I've also looked at normal footage of that particular area of the lake. It's clearly a rock. There's no disagreement there. And I think one of the things I've always appreciated about your work is your honesty about things, but also your ability to hold your hands up and say, "Well, I don't know what that is," or "No, that's not what I thought it was," or "We hope it could be this, but it wasn't." And every time you've done TV work, and when we've spoken previously, you've also always been very candid about these kind of things. And so I'm not sure some of these people get the memo that there's not much money in cryptids, unless you drop on or you capture something that people are still arguing about 50 years later, which ironically, Champ is one of those cases because of Sandra Mansey's particular photo back in what, 77 now, it's nearly 50 years ago, Christ. And so all the explanations that were put forward for that, I've still yet to see footage of a tree stump erupting from a floor of a lake to compare it with, which is the excuse that is always given as to what Sandra actually took a picture of, even to this day, and for some people. So do you think it's because Champlain is so large, Katie, that it would involve such an audacious and expensive hoax, other than mispromoting rocks as creatures, that when it comes to trying to trick people in this kind of situation, it's just too bloody hard for people.
Oh, it definitely is. I mean, it's you know what I try to do, and as you know, with my research, is I try to debunk anything that comes into play. I mean, I had one situation where a woman had said that she had seen Champ out in the bay. This was out in Fort Henry, New York, the home of Champ. And she sent me this like blurry picture, and I'm like, what the hell is that? So I'm looking at it, and I'm like, I sharpened it up, I did a little work to it, and I'm like, it's a buoy that's out. I knew exactly where it was because of the point in the background, and it's a buoy. And then she started laughing about it. I'm like, I don't think it's funny. Like, you're trying. I'm like, you can't fool. Like, when it comes to Champ, you're not gonna fool me. I know that lake. I mean, the thing is, the lake is so large. It's 120 miles long. You know, it's massive. Do I know every little nook and cranny of Lake Champlain? Hell no, I don't. My research area is what I know best, you know, and going up further to Burlington, that's an area that I know very well, very, very well, but not quite as well as the area that I research all the time, where I know that the two that I got on the sonar, Puff and Elsie that I named them, frequent that area. So, it's kind of funny, like where people try to trick you and stuff, and it's just like, come on, give me a break. And I am not the type of person who's gonna be like, well, you're full of it, if I truly think that there's definitely something. I mean, I've studied marine creatures for a very long time. I grew up in the ocean state in Rhode Island, so I mean, I'm not like from New York City living in the concrete jungle and coming out to Lake Champlain in the water and saying that I know for a fact what rolling waves are and boat wakes and that sort of thing. I truly know what I'm looking at. You know, if I can't identify something, I'm just going to tell you right out. I'm a straight shooter. I tell the way it is. Sometimes it gets me into trouble, and we've talked about that before. So, but I would rather be an honest person and tell the way it is. I might hurt some feelings, but I would rather do that than sugarcoat anything and lie to people, because I think honesty, it's truly important to me to be honest. And I take a lot of pride in the research that I do, because I tell the way it is, and I do this for the protection of not only these creatures, but Lake Champlain itself, which I don't think people in the cryptozoology community focus on the environmental aspects. And I think that's something that needs to be done. I think that's something we only have this planet for so, you know, the way we're destroying things, our waters and our forests, and but you don't ever hear about conservation much, once in a while, but it's really something that we need to focus more on.
It is striking. I think especially when it comes to Bigfoot, probably, I think Katie is probably the one where a lot of organizations and individuals just don't seem to care about the environment. And often you can see that in some of the research and investigations that go on, because they know very little about the flora and fauna of the woods and the forests, that they can misidentify and misunderstand things they hear, things they see. And I think especially obviously with the horrific things that have been happening in California with the weather recently, that always gives me a little bit of palpitations, I think, because I know the other year there were some severe fires up around Ape Canyon, which is obviously a very famous location. And I know there was a similar incident a couple of years after that in regards to where Ron Moorhead had his incident with the Sierra sounds that he caught. And on both occasions, somehow miraculously, those particular areas survived. But you only have to look at this kind of environmental impact that goes on, and then you look at the work that some of the guys are doing, say the Olympic Project, or the work that somebody like Trey Hudson does as well, where they seem to have a real sort of ecological stance to their research, on top of the fact that they want to prove that these particular cryptids are alive. And I think it's something that really more people should be involving and educating themselves about, Katie, because if anything, it'll help their research.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, knowing the flora and fauna of the area that you're working, I mean, it's just so important, and so important to understand the environment that these creatures are in. I just think is super important. I mean, like on Lake Champlain, we have a new cable going underneath the lake, which is really depressing. But I did get a chance to speak with a gentleman who's working on the project, and he had said that, you know, the amount of electricity that's going through is not invasive, and they've done some similar installation of like a similar cable in the Gulf of Mexico, and they kind of did a study on if it had any effect on some of these sharks. The migration, I think it was the whale sharks, and they say it had no effect on the whale sharks. So that kind of made me feel a lot better, because I did wonder with an animal that's echolocating how much effect it would have on them as far as their habits. Would they move in different places? Would all of a sudden you wake up one morning and there's like five of them laying on the beach, you know? Like who knows what it could do. You know, with EMF. EMF is a very powerful thing. So, it was interesting to speak with someone that's working on that project. Of course, you know, they could be blowing smoke up my butt too and just saying it's not invasive. But I've been doing a little research on it, and it seems like it's definitely not as invasive as some of the other types of cables they've put out, transatlantic type of cables on the bottom. So, I mean, I don't understand. I don't know. It's all about greed and money when it comes to projects. Like, they don't care about if they're going to mess up the environment, and it's sad. One day they're going to care because we're not going to have anything left. It's pretty sad.
Yeah, I mean, you see it all around the world when you see these situations where whales have beached themselves, and people say, "Oh, we don't know what's going on there." Well, I don't think it takes much digging to find out who's mucking about somewhere under the ocean, depending
Yeah.
whether it's the Americans, the Russians, the Chinese, us, the Europeans, whoever. There's usually somebody doing some weird tests somewhere, firing all kinds of strange apparatus about. And so when you look at somewhere like Champlain, Katie, have you noticed through your years any sort of changes to the normal animals, if we could call them such things, that inhabit this lake, that there's been any sort of changes or any new kind of visitors to it? Because often this is the case that you will, as you mentioned earlier there about some invasive species, sometimes you'll just get things popping up and you think, what the hell are they doing here? And how is this new, or have you never seen it? Because I think, like you say, the other aspect of all this is that Champlain is so big, that there's probably some strange populations of very localized creatures that, unless you stumble across them, you might not even know that they're living there.
Well, it's really interesting because I've noticed in the last probably about 13 years since I've been doing the field research anyway, there's been, I don't know what's going on, but there seems to be an overabundance of the cormorant birds. Cormorants, I don't know if you know what a cormorant, you probably do. They're like a black bird, that a diving bird. They're really not good to eat though. Like you would think, oh, it'd be a good food source. You know, maybe we could shoot them and utilize them for food. But the problem with that is they're very oily and they taste like crap. So it's just not an option with that. But you would think that they would start kind of doing some kind of population control because the fact of the matter is they're eating a lot of the small fish. Schools of small fish, smelt, which there's not a lot left in Lake Champlain like there used to be. They've got a big, they seem to be having an effect on some of the population of small fish. But for some reason, they're not really doing anything about it. So hopefully, I mean, I love all animals. You know that I'm an animal nut, but I mean, if it's going to start messing up the ecology of the lake, something definitely needs to be done. So there's an overabundance of them. And then there's also a really interesting fish, that there's been a couple reports of a possible goby fish, GOBY. And they're basically call around goby, and they come from the Black Sea and Caspian Sea. So they're definitely not native, and there's an invasive threat basically to Lake Champlain, because there's been a couple of reports of supposed goby in the Champlain Canal. So there's a lot of weird stuff. There's also the spiny water flea. There's also the zebra mussels, which were, I think, introduced to the lake. I think it was 93, 1993. But there, you know, it's kind of funny because when I look at my underwater cameras and you do see the zebra mussels, which they'll cut your feet to shreds, so don't ever step on any. What's really interesting about them is like a lot of the bottom that I'm getting video of, there's a lot of dead ones. So that's a good thing. Being invasive because their waste, the waste from the zebra mussels in general, it seems to fuel the blue-green algae in Lake Champlain, which you had the blue-green algae blooms. The waste from them feeds into that, which makes it toxic, and then you can't, you know, people can't swim or it actually is pretty lethal to dogs. If you let your dog go swimming and they ingest any of that, it can kill them. So there's all kinds of bad effects that have to do with that as well. So there's a lot of threatening things that are going on in Lake Champlain, including the sewage that's flowing in, so partially untreated sewage, millions of gallons, which nobody seems to be doing anything about, no matter how much you complain, which I have.
Oh dear. It's just one thing after another, and it's one of those things that seems to be affecting a lot of places all around the world, sadly. I mean, this is the thing as well. I think often, especially like with creatures like the zebra mussels, because they obviously they just hang around on the bottom of boats and then just fall off when they feel like it. And I suppose perhaps the only weapon you've got against some of these invasive species, especially up in Champlain, Katie, is the fact that it does get bloody cold up there in the winter, and so hopefully the water temperature drops enough to kind of knock some of these invasive species on the head.
Yeah, absolutely. Like whack-a-mole. Pop them in the head. But yeah, I mean, that's the hope anyway. But it's kind of funny with nature. I mean, look at what's going on down here in Florida. It's flipping cold. It was snowing in Pensacola this morning, which is north of where I'm at in the wintertime. But it's really interesting because, so, you know, the alligators and stuff, they go into a torpor-like state. And actually, I think it was North Carolina. There was, I forget what year it was. It's actually in my book, Water Horse of Lake Champlain, The Search. I do mention this about reptiles in the reptile section of the book, about the alligators that were in North Carolina. And it got so cold that they actually froze into the ice, and they basically put their snout right out of the ice to breathe. Yeah. And they survived it. They survived it. They had no issue. And my opinion is, with animals that are that ancient and primordial, if they've gotten through the mass extinction, which killed pretty much everything else, then they can survive anything and any change. So for alligators to survive that amount of cold and ice, I don't think that they're going to have any issues surviving. I mean, it's like with the champ animals, you know, people say, well, if there's a population in the lake, how do they survive the wintertime? Well, we've got native turtles that are ectotherms that survive the winter, and sometimes are even seen on the ice, which is a very rare occurrence, but it has happened.
Well, it is. It's one of those things. Animals have an incredible ability to adapt. And I know exactly what you're talking about. I remember seeing that footage. I think it was taken by a park ranger or somebody. And you just got all these alligator snouts sticking up from a frozen pond, which it blew my mind. I'd never seen anything like it. And they said, oh, yeah, they're fine. They're just resting.
Yeah, it's great. And there's also another case of some piranhas that were out in the land of the Ozarks. And because I don't know, someone had let some piranhas go in one of the ponds or lakes there, and people were catching these damn things. And then they actually had caught one, and they did an experiment with some piranhas in a fish tank, and they realized that they could survive extremely cold, frigid water temperature.
Mm.
And they're from the Amazon.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing how nature has a way, and that's why these animals are still here. You know, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating. And like I say, until you put certain creatures into alien situations, we don't really know. Like you say, most people, if you said to them, well, can a piranha survive in North America? You'd say, no, probably in the southern states, maybe, where it's a little bit warmer most of the year. But no chance it would be further north. But when you're in the Ozarks, you're like, well, they get some pretty bad winters. And so it just shows you that some of these creatures have far more tenacity and strength to survive things that until recently we would just presume that it would kill them off. And clearly that ain't working.
That's for sure.
So, I mean, obviously, as I mentioned, you've done several TV shows in regards to this. Obviously, I mean, the Expedition X was probably the most popular one you've been on recently, Katie, a couple of years ago. And that was quite an intriguing episode as well, because of the strange things that were going on. And even the team skeptic, Phil Torres, seemed very intrigued by what was going on. Have you had any comeback from those guys? Because I know they've started going back to some of the cases, because obviously they've kind of freshened up the team with a new member. Jessica's gone on to new opportunities and new fields, and the best of luck to her. But it seems that they're trying to revisit some. So it would be interesting to see if they wanted to come back up to Champlain. As I said earlier, because of the size of it, Katie, you would think that it's a prime location, because for most people, Champ is America's number one lake monster.
Yeah, I mean, I had no idea that they were going back to some of the past cases that they did. That's really interesting. I might need to reach out to them at some point here. And hopefully they come back. And I think that they would really find it fascinating with the findings of September 20th that I got. So hopefully, yeah, that would be really, really great to catch up with them and do a little bit more with being out on the boat because they, okay, let's just put it this way. You know, production companies, sometimes they're not always on time. They're all over the place. And I'm telling you, with working with so many of them, they're not always 100% organized. So we originally were supposed to go out in my boat, and then they decided, well, I mean, literally last minute, that they were going to just go up to a certain location and do the filming on the shore, and that's where they started talking to me about a land sighting that had happened there. So that's kind of how that turned out. So I'm hoping, if they did go back, you know, come back to the lake, we could definitely work together and do some more stuff on a boat instead of, I know they did a nighttime thing that was pretty brief, but I would love to do that with them and see if we could get some more, you know, add to more evidence that I have already. So that would be great.
Yeah, I think that's the difficulty as well, because obviously you're sort of constrained by scheduling demands and filming permits and timescales and things like that. And often when you watch the finished product, you think, oh, they must have been there ages, but often they're there for like 2 or 3 days at most, aren't they?
Yeah, sometimes even one day. Seriously.
Good luck
Seriously,
catching
I
something in that time.
well, that's the problem. That's the problem. I mean, I'm completely honest, like I said, sometimes I get a big mouth and I say too much, but you know, sometimes it is television. But I mean, I had a couple of programs in the past that had wanted to really over-exaggerate and not necessarily hoax anything, but you know, they, well, say you saw this over here. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to. That's not how I operate. That's totally the opposite of what I do. And, you know, if you guys want to say you saw something, sure, but I'm not getting involved. That's not me. I work hard at what I do, and I'm not gonna go to that level. It's not my level. So.
I suppose then, when you look back over how many years you've been doing this and the amount of time you've spent on the water and everything, would you say up until the incident on the 20th of September, you'd had your most frustrating year on Lake Champlain, Katie?
Oh, definitely 2024 was, oh, just a crap show. It really was. It was bad. We had such bad weather, the wind, the rain. I mean, each, there was two, I'm trying to remember now. I had quite a few trips up. I think one, two, I want to say it was like, I went in June. I went the end of July. And then I did go in August. And then I went in September. So I went like four times up. So it's like, it was just frustrating because every time I would go up, there was an issue with the weather. Then there was something with the boat. Oh, you gotta replace this part. And I'm like, this is getting crazy. So I'm really glad though, things happened the way they did. Because on September 20th, we got echolocation. And what's interesting about this particular echolocation is it was a completely different signature than other recordings that we've captured before. I had a woman named Cindy Jolie from Perth, Australia, who graduated from Murdoch University. I had her listen to the clip and I said, "What, tell me what you think." And she was just totally amazed. She said, "This does not compare to any type of cetacean echolocation. There's a lot of similarities, but there's big differences in this particular signature." And what I found interesting when I was listening to it, in between the clicking, you hear a buzzing sound, and that's quite different than anything I've ever captured before, or than what Elizabeth von Muggenthaler had gotten years before. Very similar in the clicks, but in between you have this distinct buzzing sound. And a lot of times in cetaceans, and like I said before, I do not believe we're dealing with a cetacean, but using that is an example of something that they're using this obviously for feeding, even if they're not a cetacean, because that's the only thing we can really compare it to is cetacean, just because of that's all we know that can echolocate is cetacean. So with this buzzing signature, usually what it means is a response with prey that has been eaten, like a direct response after, or in studies they've noticed that it happens before they catch their prey. So it was pretty interesting to get that specific signature, because I had never heard it before. I've heard it with whales, dolphins doing studies in the North Atlantic and down here off the coast of Florida, but in Lake Champlain, I've never heard that, and it was really amazing. And like I had said before, not only with just the echolocation, I had gotten previous recordings of what I believe is probably vocalizations for territorial reasons or breeding reasons. And with that being said, those recordings are just totally, totally different. It's not echolocation of any sort, but I believe that these animals have a complex language. Even with the echolocation, there's different types of echolocation. And with this certain species of animal, they definitely have tons and tons of different types of communication or echolocation for feeding. And I believe that they probably have infrasound. And that's something that I'm going to start working on, is trying to record some infrasound. And we'll see. There's probably a lot of things that we're not hearing on that certain hydrophone system, because there are different types of hydrophone systems that pick up certain frequencies. And with the infrasound, it would be amazing to see if we're, you know, there's probably a whole other series of sounds that we're not capturing that are inaudible to the human ear. So that's something in the works.
Were you surprised at how many creatures you had to compare what you caught against, Katie? Because I know, as you say, you've spoken to people from Australia. I know there's been some Japanese scientists as well, I believe, that have also sort of evaluated what you caught. I've listened to the clip as well. I also have listened to whale and dolphin noises many a time, especially when anybody says, oh, I've caught this as lake monster proof. And so you have to, even if you don't think you're ever going to do this, when you start doing something like this, Katie, you start to listen to the calls and the clicks of sea creatures and the languages that they use, because they clearly are communicating in some form. We just don't understand the reasons why properly as yet. Was it daunting having to check it against so many other species? Because I know people have suggested, oh, well, it's a dolphin. Oh, it's a killer whale. Oh, it's a white whale. You have lots of hoops to jump through before you get to the point where you can say, well, yes, we've done that, and it doesn't sound like any of them, so therefore it's something else, surely.
Yeah, it can be a daunting task. I mean, the only thing that I have to say that I'm pretty fortunate with is that I've done a lot of homework on this stuff even this winter time, last month, I was up in Tarpon Springs, and there's a huge amount of area where these manatees are coming in, and they have such an amazing language underwater, manatees. And so I did some recording of the manatees last month, which I need to post pretty soon between my 5 million projects. You know how that goes.
Yes.
So, but it was really interesting that, because I've done recordings of manatees, and going to this particular area, getting different vocalizations of manatees was really interesting, and hearing some really strange low frequency type sounds and things that I've never heard before with manatees. So in bioacoustics, we're learning new things all the time. I mean, even with whales and dolphins, there's vocalizations that they're just finding now. But going and doing the homework is the most important thing. I think you, instead of sitting at a desk and doing just the academics, you know, reading, and which is powerful tool, yes, but actually going out in the field, I think, is even more powerful, because you're doing the field work and doing comparisons, because you can look up sounds on YouTube, you know, for say a narwhal or yes, or a killer whale or whatever, and you're only going to hear a certain series of sounds and not hearing the other sounds. So going out in the field and listening to known animals and doing those comparisons is really the only way that you're going to have to catalog so many of them. There's only so much available on the internet and whatnot. So I think it's really important to get out there and study, you know, the known fish, the known, even man-made sounds, boat motors, water pumps and boats. There's all kinds of noises that could be mistaken for some strange sounds. So you just have to, it is a task. It's a lot of hours of listening. And you're like, okay, what the heck was that sound? And it's like, you know, you see a boat go by and it's got a bilge pump on. You see the water squirting out the side. It's like, oh, okay. So doing all of that for a number of years has really helped to pinpoint, this is what I'm listening to versus, oh, well, I don't know, what the hell are we supposed to be listening? There was a documentary where they had gone to Lake Champlain and they got a hydrophone and they're like, well, what are we supposed to be listening to? Well, what the hell? I mean, you've got the echolocation. You have things that you can listen to do comparisons with. So I don't know. They obviously didn't do their homework, but that's something that you need to do to rule out man-made sounds or animals that are known that are present in the area.
Absolutely. I think, as with anything, you've got to evaluate what you capture, as well as, like you say, there is only a selection of vocalizations that we have. Because I think often this is the thing, as you touched on, Katie. We've only got vocalizations in certain scenarios. There are probably a myriad of conversations and speech patterns that dolphins and whales and other such creatures use that we've either never caught, or we've never had a situation where we've been able to record them. You can only look at some of the changes in the way people view sea creatures, even over the last 10 or 15 years. You look at how people view killer whales now compared to what they thought 20 years ago about who's the most fearsome predator in the ocean, and everybody would have said, oh, well, it's easily the great white. Whereas now we know that orcas hunt and target sharks because they know how to kill them and they know how to stun them. And so that's something that's only really sort of come to fruition over the last few years. You look at the way that dolphins can create water rings underwater and play with them as though they're just having a really good time and get really giddy doing it. So you can tell that they're getting a sense of enjoyment from it. So I think often science is brilliant, but I think also we also have to understand that when we're dealing with bioacoustics, especially, that we've got a very small palette of experience in the scheme of things. And I don't know, we may probably even have 1% of their vocal range and their characteristics that we simply haven't had a chance to study properly.
That's absolutely true. I mean, up until recently, it was only, it's probably only been, I would say, probably 5 years, maybe five or maybe 10, I don't know. But it's been fairly recent in bioacoustic studies that nobody knew that alligators vocalized underwater. Nobody knew that turtles vocalized underwater. It's quite fascinating. With alligators, they have this deep, low frequency growl that can travel for miles, and that's for territorial reasons. And a lot of times when they hear this, it's around breeding time. So that's something that scientists had, bioacousticians had no clue about until recently. So, I mean, we're just touching the very minimal base of what sounds are out there that we've never heard before. And each passing year, we're going to find out more and more about these different sounds and just find more, you know, discover new sounds of what's going on. So the study for the champ animals in the future for echolocation, vocalizations, and that sort of thing, it is going to be something that's around long after I'm gone. So someone definitely needs to keep that up for sure. But I'm hoping that with this new recording that we captured, and also maybe hopefully finding some sort of infrasound that we can't hear with human hearing range. I think the future for Champ is looking pretty darn bright. It's been, because up until September 20th, it was just horrible. It was a really rough year, you know? But I was so glad that things happened the way they did. You know how they say what's meant to be is meant to be? Well, to me, it was meant to be to get that really amazing recording. And I was so I mean, I took such a sigh of relief when I figured out what I had gotten. And I'm like, oh my God, it was all worth it. So, like I always tell everybody, don't ever give up on your dreams. Don't give up on what you're doing. It's like hell sometimes to get through it, but in the end, if you hang on real tight, it's going to come to you. So, and I think this is a thing that's great for the future of protection for the species, because when I wrote the New York State law in 2019 that was passed, I'm hoping to update the law in Vermont as well. Vermont's a little bit more strained when it comes to champ. They don't take champ animals as serious as New York does for some strange reason, which is kind of a shame because, they're always like wanting tourists and tourism to come in, and you figure that they would be all for it. But they're a little bit funny over on that side of the lake, and I don't know why, but they are. They're a little funny. I don't know. It's kind of a shame, it really is. Because I mean, look at Loch Ness. It's not a lot of people that have no clue that have never been to Lake Champlain are always like, oh, they just make up this whole thing for tourism. There is no freaking tourism. There's nothing. There's hardly anything about champ on the lake. And then you have people come in. I'm going to make $1 million selling champ souvenirs. Oh, good luck with that. Good luck with it. Because I mean, I've done it. I've sold souvenirs. I've done all that. And then guess where the money goes? Right back into my boat parts or whatever, gas. I mean, and the equipment that costs a fortune that I use. But nobody gets rich with this stuff. And there's so many people that come out of the woodwork and they think I'm going to be a millionaire. And okay, you end up spending more money on, I mean, it's not about that, but you do have people that think that you're doing it as a cash cow. And they think that you're making $1 million from what you're doing. And I'm like, okay, let them think that, but it's not really happening. It's just not happening.
There's only so many plushies you can sell.
Well, that's it, and any of the funding that I get from selling any merchandise like my books and whatnot, goes right back into the research because the ROV, the underwater robot, that that was really expensive, and the sonar unit, which is military grade sonar. And you get some people that are like, oh, well, she just talks about how much it costs. And well, hell yeah, it costs a lot of money to do this stuff. It's really, it's a lot of hard work to get the funds to get the equipment. And it's really important now that we've come this far with technology today, that this is what's going to prove that these animals are here. It's the technology, and it's getting better and better every year. So yeah, of course it's important. Of course it's expensive. You're not going to find anything just sitting around on your couch. Like I've always said before, you've got to have boots on the ground. We're fortunate to have much better technology now as well. So I mean, things are definitely getting better, and that's why we're getting more results. And I think it's great.
Has this experience changed the way you're going to attack it this year, Katie? Because, as you've said, you've had a very frustrating year last year. You had problems, you had mechanical malfunctions, you had situations that kind of stopped you doing what you wanted to do. Have you now thought, well, if I've caught this in September, that would mean, does this happen every year? I mean, prior to this, to last year, Katie, had you been out on the lake that late in the season?
No, I mean, usually I'm pretty much done by the beginning of September. I have done, I'm trying to think what program it was. It was for the Travel Channel called Paranormal Declassified. That particular episode, we were out in like January, and I'm
Ooh.
like, and I don't know what the heck it is, but like they always want to film when it's wintertime, and I'm like, why? What the heck? And it's I guess it's just the time frame of getting out, for the new season, the new TV season type of thing. And they always want to film in the winter. And I'm like, oh, good Lord, Oh, well, can we rent a boat? Well, good luck with that. And for some reason, they happened to get hold of, I think it was someone with a University of Vermont that had a huge pontoon boat, two of them. And we managed to get out on the lake. So that's the craziest time I've ever been out floating on the water in January. Usually I'd be ice fishing. But yeah, seriously, September 20th was the latest, myself personally, that I've gotten out on Lake Champlain on my own boat. But January was, yeah, it was around beginning of January when we filmed that episode for the Travel Channel. Yeah, it was quite strange to me. I'm like, how the hell, why am I out here? And it was actually quite warm. And this was the beginning of COVID. This when COVID started. And after we did that filming, I got sick as a dog, and I think I got COVID. And it was, everybody was traveling from like California. So I'm like, someone gave me the COVID. I don't know who it was, but a few of us ended up sick with it. So yeah, I remember that's specifically when it was, because I was sick as a dog after. So yeah, that was around that time frame.
I suppose it kind of changes it because you've had tantalizing morsels of data and potential evidence over the years, Katie. And as I said, here you are 13 years in now. Have you, obviously you've had this sort of preset planning where you sort of do June to late August, but with this going on in September, does that mean now this year you're thinking, I'm really going to sort of be there at the beginning of autumn? Because, I mean, the other thing, like we've touched on, when we look at other creatures, it's that time of year where perhaps they are communicating about migrating. It may be in regards to, like you say, mating calls. It could be somebody going, hello, where are you? We don't know. There could be a variety of reasons for it. But for me, when you look at that, you would have to say to yourself now, Katie, even without a big court, you've got to be up there in September now getting ready for that, because surely if it's happened once, there's a chance that's going to be the best time again, isn't it?
Absolutely. I totally agree with that, because when I had my first experience in 2014, it was really actually, no, it was 2012. What am I talking about? 2014 is when I got the video of the same. I don't know if it was the same animal, but it probably was going in the same direction at the same time. And it was, I'm trying to think of the date exactly. It was around like the same week of when I had my first sighting.
Yeah.
So going back, I think we talked about this in previous podcasts about the habitual thing with animals, where say if you see deer in a field at this particular time, they may not be there every single night at that time, but if you go back consistently, you're going to see them again at the same time doing the same type of habits and whatnot.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely. I think in this specific location that I went to, which was very central to sighting area, the sonar area, the previous echolocation area, I call it the Champ Triangle. it's a great spot to go, and there's a huge, and I know why, because looking at the sonar, the amount of fish that are in this area is just, it's mind-boggling. I mean, you can go from down in Port Henry, New York, where there's, you know, you have abundance of fish and stuff, but this past year was like, it was dead, and I'm like, what the hell is going on? And then I got out to this area, and there's schools of all these bait fish going around. I'm like, wow, look at this. And that's where I'm like, you know what? This is a good area right here for feeding. So that's when I stopped. I dropped the hydrophone in. And at first, I basically took the headphones off and laid them on the seat, because it was quite hot that day for September, the end of September. Because we do have Indian summers is what they call, what they're called, when it gets quite warm. So I think it was around 80 degrees, and I was just really warm in the sun, because I don't have a bimini top on the boat right now, so it was quite warm. So I had the headphones on my head, and I took them off because my ears started getting really sweaty and stuff, and I laid them on the seat, and I was talking with my friend Marty, and I said, Marty's like, what the hell is that noise? I'm like, I don't know, and we heard the clicking from the headphones laying on the seat. And I'm like, what the heck? So I pick up the headphones and I put them on. I'm like, Marty, I think we got echo. I'm always skeptical. I'm such, and that's the thing that a lot of people don't realize with me. I'm not the type to jump at the first thing and go, oh yeah, it's echolocation, it's Champ. I got to listen to it over and over and do comparisons, because, you know, I don't want to put something out there that I'm not 1,000,000% sure myself. I'm very fussy with that. Unlike the guy at the Loch Ness camera situation. Oh my God. We got to make up a song. We got to make up a song about that fellow because he's quite interesting. But he would be like, oh, buddy, oh my God, it's this. Yeah, I can just hear it now. But I'm very careful with what I put out there. I'm very, very thorough with my research. So I said, well, I'm pretty sure that's echolocation, but I'm going to give it a listen later, and go over it. And I did many, many times do the comparisons and voila. So, I think going back to that location this next year, I think that'll be great. I think using an abundance of underwater cameras in this location as well, which I didn't really get to do a lot of this year in conjunction. It's always kind of a struggle to get like so many things. The water was just really, really murky this past year because we had a lot of flooding in Vermont with all of the rain. So there was a lot of runoff. So the clarity, of course, all these lakes, you know, that have creatures, they're never clear like we want them to be. I mean, Loch Morar is pretty, pretty darn clear, which that's the place that I'm looking forward to checking out this spring.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Loch Ness is renowned because of the location and the runoff from the hills around it. Loch Ness is infamously dark. You know, having been there myself, I know that firsthand. You can literally from the surface see about 2 foot down and that's it. Then it's just like a greeny black.
Yeah, the
peat. Scary thing.
the peat content's pretty high in there, and
yeah,
the visibility just really sucks. And I am planning on going on a trip to Loch Ness and Loch Morar. I'm hoping probably the beginning of May. Not quite sure exactly the date yet. I'm working on my passport, which everybody thinks I can just go to the post office and get it right away. But there's a huge waiting list. So I'm due to go there next week and get my passport sorted and my ETA, which is a thing that you got to do now to go to the UK. And, I'm really looking forward to using the same type of technology that I've had luck with at Champlain. And, I think checking out Loch Morar, which is going to be really amazing because of the clarity and the fact that, you know, it's not crowded like Loch Ness. You know, you don't have all this touristy stuff going on as you do with Loch Ness. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun to check out that area. And then I'd like to go down to Silver Sands, which is right down the road from there. Beautiful, beautiful scenery on the salt water and just check that out as well. So it's going to be an interesting trip, and I'm going to have to really learn how to drive on the other side of the road, which I know that you're used to that, but I'm an American girl and I've been watching on the VR headset to prepare myself so I won't have a heart attack. I'm like, wee, oh no. Yeah. I've been doing my study work on that.
Yeah. You've been practicing your roundabouts.
Yes, I have. The roundabout.
I'm going to say, if you're going to Scotland in May, you're definitely going to need a big coat. As well, Katie.
Oh, yeah.
May in Scotland can be many things.
Yes. Yeah, I've got my Amazon wish list going on with the rain coats, the rain gear, the thick socks, all that fun stuff. But definitely, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And I mean, trying the type of protocol that I use on Champlain that no one's ever tried before, I think is going to be really interesting, because if we do get something, we can do comparisons, and if we're getting the same type of echolocation sounds or vocalizations or sonar images, you know, it's going to be really great to compare. And no one's ever really done that with stuff from Champlain, so it's going to be quite interesting.
Yeah, especially Morag, because she gets very much overlooked, I think. Everybody's eyes are sort of to Loch Ness, whereas when you look at it, there's been a fair number of strange sightings on Loch Morag, to the point that when I went to Scotland, I went there and spoke to one of the locals there, who it took about 5 minutes for them to realise I wasn't pulling their leg and trying to take their Michael out of them. But they were saying, yeah, it's amazing, because as far as they were concerned, they thought Loch Ness was a load of old stuff and nonsense, but there was definitely something in Loch Moray that nobody knew what it was, which I always find very interesting. I mean, there's a lot of romanticism and nonsense, as we've touched on several times, in regards to some of the things that are reported up at Loch Ness. You know, I've spoken to somebody who's absolutely adamant they've seen something there. I mean, when I was there, I could not imagine anywhere better in the United Kingdom for something to be keeping out of the way of everything, because I was lucky enough to go on Loch Ness and obviously spoke to the boat pilot, and he'd got his sort of sonar on and showing us how deep it goes down. And, you know, the fact it's deeper than the English Channel, which is one of those things that still amazes people when you tell them. But the locals down at Loch Moray, no. There's something here. There's nothing there. And I suppose very differently in regards to Champlain, because Champlain had a history through the local tribes and the Native American peoples that lived around that lake. It was well established. I mean, this is the thing that often gets on my nerves a little bit in regards to that a lot of people, I think when they don't understand the history of that particular region of the US, they all presume that it only started, as with a lot of these things, that once Loch Ness hit the headlines in 1933, Katie, all of a sudden everybody else around the world said, oh, well, we've got a monster here as well.
I totally agree with that. I mean, I've seen comments from people on in regards to some of the land sightings that have happened around Champlain. They're like, oh, she's just making that up. That comes Loch Ness. And it's like, I'm hearing this from locals that don't even have any clue about anything at Loch Ness with the land sightings, because that's something that only really people that are really, really into cryptozoology really know about, you know. And I mean, the people that I've talked to, they're type of people that they don't even use the damn internet, you know. It's true. I'm serious. I mean, a couple of the people that I talk to are just old school people, 80 years old, been in that area forever, their whole life, that have had land sightings. They didn't know anything about anything at Loch Ness with the land sightings. So, you know, it's just, it's really fascinating to see the similarities. I mean, it's just, I'm so excited to get over there, because I'm going to try things that, you know, no one else has ever done at Loch Ness or Loch Morar, and Loch Morar is so remote. I'm particularly excited about Loch Morar than I am with Loch Ness, even though, you know, it's a touristy thing and I want to get some Nessie slippers to run around the house in. But I think Loch Morar is probably going to be the more promising of the two.
Yeah, it is surprising when people dismiss the land sightings of Nessie as well as they do with Champ, Katie, because like you say, I think you've really got to drill down into them, primarily because there's not been many in the modern era when it comes to Nessie. I mean, I can think of probably three or four in the latter half of the 20th century. You've got the very famous ones from the 30s, and the one that always gets overlooked, which kind of puts a pin in the balloon of scepticism that it only started in 1933, which I think is that, I've forgotten his surname, but it was a chap called Jock on a motorbike who saw it in 1919 waddling across the road. You've got these historical reports. I mean, I think there was a group of kids in the 70s who saw it waddling on the beach back in there, and nobody believed them because they thought they were all kids, but they've never changed their story since. And so you still have that with Champ, and I suppose this is the problem, because for a lot of people, as far as they're concerned, when it comes to Nessie and Champ and other lake creatures, they've got this idea in their mind that they're all long necked serpents that are just swimming about with their heads stuck out. But the more you look at the reports and the cases for creatures all around the world, I mean, Ogopogo is another prime example. People are seeing enormous things swimming through these bodies of water, Katie, but they're also reporting very odd encounters with something on land, which straight away you think, well, that can only be one type of species as far as we're aware, even though we do know that octopi can walk and quite happily mooch about on rocks and things and go from pool to pool. And there are certain breeds of fish that walk to the next body of water as though they're like some unstoppable force. There are creatures, once again, I think we are sometimes constrained by our belief that we've studied everything, and yet we keep seeing aquatic animals do things that we used to think was impossible 20 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, around Lake Champlain in particular, there's been quite a few reports of these snake-like creatures with no appendages, which don't even fit into some of the on-land sightings of Champ, you know, finding webbed footprints, four-toed webbed footprints, like very much like an alligator, like a webbed foot. And some of these reports are just amazing where they don't see any appendages on the creature. It's like, what the hell is that? I mean, the only thing that I could think of is maybe there's some kind of giant eel, an ancient type of eel, because it was the Champlain Sea at one time. So either that or some kind of giant snake. We really don't know. But some of the reports that I've gotten, one in particular about, I think it was around 6 years ago, the girl was driving home from work from Middlebury, Vermont, and she lived in Port Henry. So there's like a cut through, and she was on this road, and there's the lake on one side and there's a swamp on the other. It's around 4 o'clock in the morning. Very misty that morning, which, you know, they, for some reason, so a lot of these sightings do happen like when there's a mist or a fog and that sort of thing. But it was really interesting that she saw this thing crossing the road. She actually had to stop her car. She didn't want to run over it because it was really, it was so big. Like, it was stretched across the road. I measured the road, and I believe the road was 21 feet wide.
Right.
So I'm like, holy crap. And this thing covered the whole road. Like, that's how long this thing was. And so she didn't know what the heck to do. And she didn't want to run over and kill it. Well, probably would approve whatever, whatever it was. But it was interesting because she said, because she lived in Florida for some time and seen some very large snakes, pythons and whatnot. She goes, it didn't move like that. It had that vertical type of undulation. Hmm. And very, very much how an eel would move on land. So it makes me wonder what the heck else is out there. I mean, I think we're dealing with maybe more than one thing in Champlain. Because some of the sightings are weird like that, just snake-like creatures with no appendages and that sort of thing. So, I mean, who knows, maybe as they grow older, they develop appendages. We really don't know. It's so strange. But, you know, there are more than one type of prehistoric fish in Lake Champlain. You get the bowfin, the gar, the sturgeon, the sea lamprey. They go back 100+ million years. So if all those species of fish are in Lake Champlain still, who's to say we're not dealing with an ancient type of turtle with some strange sightings and the champ animals, what I call the champ animals, with appendages or snake-like creatures as well. So there's a couple strange things going on there for sure.
Well, as well, and the thing about the reports where people are clearly describing different types of creature, like you say, we, yeah, once again, without wishing to sound like I'm repeating myself, there are so many species around the world that when they're maturing, they change quite considerably into when they become adults. You especially when it comes to fish and aquatic animals, insects are obviously probably the best example of that. But you see it constantly. And so, like you say, it could either be people are seeing a juvenile before it develops and changes into something else. Or why wouldn't there be two different types of creatures there? This is what I don't understand when people say, oh, well, people are describing snakes, but these people seem to be describing some kind of amphibian. Therefore, they must, one of those people, if not both, are making it up. But why wouldn't there be two unknown species? Like you say, because there are historically well-adapted creatures like a sturgeon, like a lamprey, that can seemingly exist anywhere in the world if given the opportunity. Once again, showing the versatility and the strength of creatures to deal with the trials and tribulations that nature throws them. And if they couldn't, Katie, we wouldn't have a problem with invasive species all around the world, would we?
That's That's very true.
So, do you think that when you're hearing that, like you've just said, do you think it could be a mixture of both? It could be one or the other. It could be juvenile and adult, or we could be dealing with two or more different creatures here. They're just all undiscovered. We just, once again, the size of the area, there could be anything there.
Yeah, I think we're dealing with a couple, at least at Champlain, a couple of different things that are going on for sure. I mean, but who's to say like the young champ animal, but I mean, this thing was 21 feet long. So that's
Yeah.
not, I mean,
Well,
the
no,
normal
not.
size for, yeah, no kidding. I know.
I don't want to meet mum and dad. Christ.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're dealing with different species going on, particularly with that. That report, with no appendages, with it being that large, I think we're definitely dealing with something totally different than what the champ animals are. So, it's a mystery. I mean, there's a lot of strange things out there that we're yet to discover, but, you know, being out on the lake all the time and putting in the hours, I mean, that's the biggest thing is to put in the hours of observation and using the equipment and whatnot. I think this is what's so important to identifying what these creatures are and protecting the species, for sure.
So have you already decided on your itinerary this year, Katie, in regards to when you're going to go up and what you're going to do first? Or is it the case of you're going to keep to the normal patterns that you've done, you're just going to extend it a bit further into September this time because of what's happened last year?
Yeah, I think for sure. I think that's my plan is to just extend it into the latter part of September. Depends on the weather too, though. If it starts getting really, really cold and the weather starts getting really bad and that sort of thing, then it's going to change our plans because going out in the lake that's that massive, it can be quite dangerous. And I do have a new research boat, which I haven't told anybody really about yet. It's a pontoon boat, and I had a couple people say, "Well, that's kind of dangerous out on a lake like that." Well, I'll tell you what, Kelpie 2, I love the boat, but it's got some age to it, and I got this one that's a lot newer. It's only, let's see, 9 years old, so fairly new compared to that. And what I like about it, and the reason why I figured I would switch to a pontoon, it's one level. There's a ton of storage for my equipment going in and out of the cabin down below. It was just such a pain. I mean, there's not really that much room down there. I mean, anywhere I want to sleep, which I slept up in the front, but there is like a little cuddy cabin underneath the stairs that was full of my equipment. And then I had some up on the deck, and it's just like, man, I need something that's going to be more one level. That I have easy access to everything. I don't have to climb up and down the stairs. Plus, you got to worry about a bilge pump. If you got some water coming in and the bilge pumps aren't working, it's one more thing that you have to fix. So I said, I'm gonna go with a pontoon boat. And I've driven pontoon boats, and what I like about them is you can have some serious waves, and those things are pretty stable. A lot of people will think the opposite. Oh, you're gonna sink. I mean, there's no bilge pumps on a pontoon boat. The water's just going to roll right off. It's quite different. So I don't know yet. I'm kind of debating if I'm going to use Kelpie 2 this year for the last season or just bring in Kelpie 3. So we'll see what happens with that. But I plan on doing a similar pattern like I did this past year because obviously it worked with being there a little bit later. If the weather is not favorable, then I'm going to have to change my plans a little bit. But you have to go by the weather because of how sketchy it can be on the lake. So the weather is going to be key.
Is there anything you're planning to do differently this year or try something you've never attempted previously, Katie?
Well, I am going to try to. I always try not to tell too much because then someone's out there trying to do the same thing. I hate that. So let's say I try
Okay, what can you
to.
say?
Okay. The infrasound thing I'm working on, that I will say, maybe capturing infrasound, getting that type of technology involved, and probably I'd like to go in certain areas with a stationary underwater camera where there's been sightings near this particular camp. I'm friends with the people that own the camp, and they said that I could set up my hydrophone, I can set up underwater cameras. in this vicinity where one of these creatures had been seen along a ledge. So I'm excited about that, to try that as well and just keep round the clock surveillance. I usually do that while I'm on the boat, but the clarity this past year was really crappy. So hopefully this year it'll be a lot better. So that type of thing, perhaps getting something like underwater footage. I plan on spending a little bit more time onshore too, because I've been doing so much on the boat that it's really hard to see anything like that's coming up on the surface when you're level with the water. I don't have a flying bridge on the boat, so I'm not like at a high vantage point.
Yeah.
I plan on doing a little bit more surveillance with that. I mean, I could set up some webcam type of thing. I'm working on that as well with the person that owns the camp. Maybe set up some live webcam where people can watch from home. There's a couple on the lake, but they're not that great. So those are the things that I'm working on. And I'm going to try to work with a television program to do some further scientific type of testing that I tried before, but it wasn't successful because things had gotten degraded. So I'm working on that as well. But there's a certain way to test for certain species that was not done with the previous eDNA test. So that's what I'm working on. And I'm doing a lot of studying of scientific papers and the protocol to prepare samples and stuff like that. So that's the plan, without getting into it too much.
Well, infrasound's quite interesting as well, because obviously it's one of those buzz terms that gets used as an explanation for all kinds of strange things these days. But it's only mysterious if you don't know anything about it. And you once you dive into it, you realize its range and what the effects it can have. But I'm intrigued by that, because obviously there are certain types of aquatic creatures that are very sensitive to infrasound. And that would suggest that they've developed that because they needed to know what it was, Katie, because they don't, you know, cod and octopus are not going to suddenly think, I'll tell you what I need to learn about and be aware of is infrasound. Because usually you would suggest any animal has an adaptation to something, it's because they've needed it as protection or to be aware of it for protection. And so I think when it comes to the capabilities of creatures to use it and sense it, it's a very new idea. Because I know I was talking to somebody about this recently, and I ended up falling down a rabbit hole about cod and infrasound. And basically there was like a 40-year argument about cod, because somebody said that they discovered it in the 80s that cod were very sensitive to it, and a lot of other scientists poo-pooed it. And now it's pretty well known that any fish with a swim bladder, they suggest, is probably able to take it even down to like one hertz and be able to recognize what that is, which is remarkable, really. And so you think, well, why do these creatures need to know what infrasound is? Surely that means that there must be something out there somewhere that uses it, maybe like a lion does, because we know that lions can project it. So that's an intriguing strand you've decided to pull on there.
Well, yeah, I mean, I got thinking of some of the different particular sightings that I've gotten reports of, where people have been fishing and they're over in a certain location, and then all of a sudden the fish stop biting and they're like, what the hell is going on? Like perch in particular, which I think are a huge food source for the champ animals, by the different locations where I've filmed them on video underwater cameras. And there's been a lot of sightings in these areas, and I've been finding an abundance of perch, some smelt, which there's not a lot of smelt left anymore, which is kind of a sad thing for some fishermen, because a lot of people like to eat smelt, and champ apparently like smelt as well. So in these areas where there's a concentration of certain types of fish, I mean, I always hear people say, oh, they probably eat sturgeon. Well, sturgeon can get very large. They got armored plating. I don't think it would be that easy of a feed for them. Their head is probably the size of a horse's head. So but maybe take a chunk out of one and try, maybe. But I just don't. I think the bait fish And going into the swampy areas, these marshes around Lake Champlain, which there's over 300,000 acres of marshland, which is amazing amount of space. They're going in for the easy feed, so to speak, the small fish and perhaps snakes and turtles and even maybe vegetation, because there's been vegetation found in an ancient reptile that we know today called the American alligator. I mean, they've done dissections on alligators and found fruit in their stomach, and all different kinds of grass. So they're opportunistic. Not only are they carnivorous, but they are also opportunistic as well. So I think with the infrasound, what I got thinking about it, and I'm like, with these reports of fish that stop biting, those fish are hearing something. I mean, it could be just the echolocation, but there also could be some kind of infrasound that's going on that is stunning the fish. Like, we got to get the heck out of here. It's like a warning to them.
Yeah.
And that's just something that I really think needs to be looked into for sure.
Well, it's intriguing. And as always, I will wish you the very best of luck. And let's hope you get even more enticing and thrilling morsels of data and some more echolocations. I mean, obviously, as we said at the beginning, you winter in Florida. Have you thought about looking into some of the strange water-based creatures that are supposed to be lurking in some of the lakes and the myriad of sea serpent stories that emanate from Florida's coasts?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've kind of like made a little plan of doing certain areas. I've basically, what I've been doing lately is recording a population of manatees over near Tarpon Springs and getting vocalizations from them and doing some comparisons and that sort of thing. But there are some stories like Lake Okeechobee. There's stories back from like the Native Americans that have seen long serpent-like creatures in Lake Okeechobee. And I think the Native stories are really fascinating because these people lived from the land. They knew the difference between an alligator, which there's like the highest population of alligators in Lake Okeechobee. So I like to check out that area, the swamps of that area. I mean, we could be dealing with some kind of giant snakes. I mean, there's a lot of snakes down here, so that could be what's going on. There's a lot of possibilities, but there's also a place near Tarpon Springs called Lake Tarpon. But I've heard weird reports from there, but they're kind of tongue in cheek. There's not really many. What's really kind of stupid about those reports that I've seen artist depictions of this thing, and it's like a bipedal type of dinosaur, almost like looking at like a raptor or T-Rex or whatever, like with these little arms. I'm like, what the hell is that? Like, that's not a typical, I don't know, some knucklehead made that one up, but it doesn't mean that there's something going on there, because what I found interesting looking at satellite images of this Lake Tarpon, there is an underwater connection to Tampa Bay. So something could be coming in from the ocean. We don't know. So that's a place, I think that's number one on my list to check out. And then there's the other one called Pinky. I don't know if you've heard of Pinky.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have the pink dolphins that pop up on occasion as well. So who knows what's going on? But I would like to check those out. And I've been working on a magazine, as we were talking about earlier, that is really – it's been a project because – I didn't think it'd be this much work, but you know how we talked about earlier, once you get into a project, sometimes you find out later that it's a little bit more extensive than you thought.
Yes.
But the magazine is called 14 World, and it's going to cover 14 subjects, UFOs, cryptozoology, supernatural as well. So it's been quite an adventure with the magazine, and I'm looking forward to releasing that hopefully next week. And anybody that wants to find out about the magazine, any info will be available on my website at www.katieelizabeth.org. And it's digital subscription for now. I want to see how well the magazine does. And I think it's really great to have a digital magazine because, you know, back in the day when you heard digital magazine, you're like, oh, well, that's kind of lame. We were so used to paper magazines.
Yeah.
And nowadays it's like nobody wants a big pile of magazines sitting in their bathroom anymore. It takes up so much room. It's not only that, it's also, I think it's more conservation for the environment for trees, you know, where we got digital instead of wasting paper. So it's going to be great because there's going to be a lot of interactive videos and links that you can actually click on to check out more of different researchers that have contributed to the magazine. We've got Richard Freeman, who did a great article on the Mongolian Death Worm expedition that he did some time back. We've got Richard Muirhead, he's like the catalog guy of finding out all kinds of sightings of strange creatures. And so we've got those guys doing some articles and various others that are contributing. So I'm pretty excited about the new venture with the magazine, which is going to be quarterly. Because honestly, once my research really starts, I'm not going to have time to do a monthly magazine. So I'm doing it quarterly.
Excellent. Well, I wish you the very best of that. And Richard, both Richards, their work and reputations precede them. Like I say, I always see Richard popping up asking about strange creatures on a variety of message boards, and I think, oh dear, what rabbit hole has Richard fallen down now? So it could be anything going on there. Yes, I mean, yeah, Pinky's one I've heard of, and I'm trying to think if it was Florida. I'm sure it is. There's some remarkable footage from about 30 years ago of some weird creatures sort of rolling about in a river somewhere, which I'm sure is Florida. And I can't remember, Katie, if it was on Sightings or on a really old episode of Unsolved Mysteries. But that was one of those where people had said, oh, well, we think it's a manatee. And then when they studied the footage, they realized it couldn't be. And even if it was acting extremely unusual for a manatee because they're renowned for being very docile, placid creatures. And this was sort of thrashing about and doing all kinds of things. So you never know. I mean, the other one I always remember about Florida is it Lake Clinch, which is in Polk County, I think it is supposed to have a long history going back to the tribes with a strange creature living there. So that might be
Yes.
one to see if there's anything hiding in there as well for you to keep you busy when the weather gets better.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's probably the closest to me because I'm in Polk County. But Polk County is like the size of my home state of Rhode Island. It's so huge. It's like you're driving and it's like, welcome to Polk County. And then it's like, you're still in Polk County. And then I'm like, how big is Polk County? It's crazy. So yeah, I'll definitely have to check that. Maybe I'll do that one first since it's closer and see what kind of results I get with that for sure.
I suppose as well, Katie, what I've learnt over the last few years is the amount of these weird limestone caverns that are dotted all over Florida. Because one of the problems Florida has is obviously a lot of it's on limestone, and it gets hit by a lot of hurricanes. And unfortunately, this means that there are certain areas where the ground is essentially collapsing. I remember watching a documentary about this a few years ago, and there was a man on there who's one of those people when you see somebody say, right, I'm going to do this, and you'd think, Jesus Christ. And he went free diving on a golf course. He jumped under a lake. I think the lake was on the golf course, and he was basically, he got all the aqualung on and everything, all the apparatus, and he was swimming under this golf course and popped out in a outside a shopping centre because the water had just gone through all the limestone, and essentially you'd now got like an underwater sea in this particular area of Florida. And he was saying, oh, there's loads of these. It's remarkable. And you only think, well, you would think that there's going to be something like that that may even connect to the sea, no?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, like I said, and Lake Tarpon, I guess there's like an underwater connection that goes to what is it? Not Tarpon, Tampa Bay. And there's so many aquifers down here that's one thing I really find interesting. There's a place called Blue Springs that's north of here. And there's been many divers that have, they actually take your, if you plan on diving there, they'll take your driver's license. That way, when you get done diving, that they have a head count to make sure you're not missing. You know, like, okay, this person took their driver's license. Yeah, I'm serious, crazy. And there's these aquifers that people have gone into and never down in these vents where this water's coming out and these people have not returned. So, I mean, there's so many underwater limestone caverns and crevices. I mean, right behind my house, I have a lake and our water comes from the lake and we have the whole filtration system and stuff, but it comes out of this aquifer. And God knows, I mean, I could, I would never do it because I wouldn't have the guts to do it like that guy. Because you don't know if you're going to get stuck on what, how do you know that you're going to be able to come back out? If you get in there far, so far, and you have no exit to get the hell out of there and you don't have enough oxygen in your tank, you know, that's the end. That's the total end. So, I mean, going out here in the little lake, that's only about eight acres. They call them lakes down here. And I always laugh because I'm like, it's not a lake. That's a pond. Because I'm used to Champlain, you know, I'm so used to Champlain. But yeah, going out here, I mean, there could be caverns that go all the way up to Orlando. I have no idea. I mean, we just don't know. And there are sinkholes where people's houses have fallen in and cars have fallen in. And I'm like, wow, it's pretty scary. There's a lot of scary stuff down here. I mean, not only invasive pythons and crazy hurricanes that go through and blow siding off your house like it did to me with Hurricane Milton. I mean, we've got a lot of crazy stuff down here. I just, yeah, I mean, who knows what's in these caverns and where they go? And there could be, you know, with bull sharks, as you know, they can go into fresh water very easily and they're extremely aggressive. And people think they're safe in the fresh water, but that's not the case. It's not the case.
I watch a lot of terrifying documentaries about Florida, Katie. There's nothing you're telling me I don't know. To be honest, I saw, strangely enough, talking about bull sharks, I saw where there was one residential area, which is essentially like these beautiful houses. I'm not sure if it's near Miami. And they've got like these canals around it. Beautiful. And it was great for a few years. And now they've noticed that they've just got bull sharks swimming up and down them all the time.
Well, you know, the water's getting warmer, which is like really, okay, I'm from New England, so Rhode Island off the coast, when you went swimming, you didn't go swimming until like August because the water was so cold. And now it's so warm. I was at Anna Maria Island last year and I went swimming because it's so crystal clear and gorgeous. And I'm out there and I'm trying to swim around. And I'm like, ew, it was so warm. I mean, it was warmer than bath water. It was almost hot. And I'm like, this is so strange. And that's why more of these sharks are coming in closer to shore and more attacks are happening because of the change of the temperatures going on. Even Lake Champlain's starting to warm up a lot more significantly than it used to. So I'm kind of curious to see what effect it's going to have on the champ animals, being an ectotherm. They do go into a state of, brumation in the winter and estivation, I believe, is when it gets warm, too warm. Although, you know, they do favor the warm water, but there's a limit there. I mean, it's from warm to really, really warm. So I'm kind of curious what's going to happen in Lake Champlain with the water temperature change as well. But everything's getting really strained weather-wise. I mean, we just had snow down here, not where I am, but north of me, and it's like, what the heck? I mean, although I think it was, this thing is the first time in 40 years it snowed in Florida. That much. So, I mean, but you know, you got to think of it too. The world's probably gone through all kinds of changes way before we were born. So, I mean, that it may not be just global warming. It could be just something that we've never seen in our generation. But there, we definitely have an issue with pollution, obviously, and destroying our planet. And I think that's, you know, the most important thing is to raise the awareness of conservation of biology and our ecosystems with the study of cryptozoology.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Well, Katie, it's been fabulous to catch up with you as always. I'm very excited and hopeful that you'll get even more incredible evidence this year. And let's hope we can build and find, get some more echolocation recordings and other strange things going on. Where can everybody follow your work? Keep up to date with it. Subscribe to the new magazine when it's coming. And also anything else in regards to your previous books that you've had published?
Oh gosh, okay. So, Facebook is probably my biggest outlet right now. Thank God it's not TikTok because of that whole TikTok shut off for a little, like not very long, but it happened. So they can go to my Facebook page. I've got a few. There's Champ Search on Facebook. There's my personal page, Katie Elizabeth. You'll see like there's a lot of Katie Elizabeths, but there's basically a thing that says cryptozoologist and whatnot. So you can kind of differentiate, me between the millions of Katie Elizabeths listed on Facebook. And then my website, which is www.katieelizabeth.org. And I'm going to do some updating on the main website where I'm going to have information how to subscribe to the new magazine and videos on future expeditions. I do have a YouTube channel called Unclassified Films, and they can see the recent echolocation recordings, listen to them, and see some of the footage of us out on the lake aboard Kelpie 2 when we heard this echolocation. And that video is really fun to watch because there's a lot of drone footage of Kelpie 2 out there on the lake. And you can actually get a little bit of a feel of just the research area that I work on in this massive body of water. You look at, I mean, I look at the footage and I'm like, wow, how the heck did I do this? How did I do this? But it's just persistency, and not giving up, even when your boat's not running the best and the weather's not the best. So, definitely the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So people can check all of the, and I do live videos on the lake a lot as well.
Yep.
And that usually starts from June on. July, August, September are the 3 months that are the best sighting months. So that's when I really get things cooking on there. So they can definitely check it out on the website and on my Facebook page.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links to everything as always. And I just want to say thank you for joining me. Always lovely to catch up and find out what's going on and get down to the bottom of your research and what you've got planned for the upcoming year. I wish you the very best of luck, and hopefully we'll speak soon when you've caught a picture of Champ smiling for me.
I can't wait till that happens.
Take care.
Thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate it.